Welcome back to another episode of Seven Deadly Sinners. Thank you guys so much for listening and for your positive reviews and five-star ratings on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and wherever you listen. It really helps the show and it really helps people find the show. So thank you. And thank you to those of you that are listening to our sister podcast, Deadly Diocese. The amount of tips that have come in from you all regarding Father Joe's suspicious death have been so invaluable. Thank you so much for that. And now for the story of a doomed romantic love triangle, set in the backdrop of America's gold rush. This is the story of Isabel Springer and the murder at the famous Brown Palace Hotel, all to win her affections. It's a story that echoes today, leaving the Palace Hotel and the marble bar where the tragic scene went down, haunted with the ghosts of lovers past and perhaps the ghosts of the victims of that fateful night. So for this case, the sin I'm going with is twofold. Well, actually threefold. It's a story that began with lust and ended in an envious wrath. And you'll see why when the story wraps up. Set in the backdrop of the booming late 19th century and early 20th century, the vibe of the era was still partially the Wild West, but the West had struck gold. Many men became millionaires seemingly overnight, and the indulgence of the time did not go unnoticed, as Denver became a hot spot, specifically the Brown Palace Hotel, where our crime scene takes place. This was the hub of excess and decadence. It was the playground of Denver's elite. And its storied history has played host to numerous luminaries, including Buffalo Bill Cody, John Philip Sousa, several Barrymores, Lillian Russell, Mary Pickford, and the Beatles. Presidents from Teddy Roosevelt to George W. Bush have visited there. Dwight Eisenhower and his wife Mamie, who grew up in Denver, spent many of their vacations within its walls. The International Summit of the Eight was headquartered in the plush surroundings in 1997. Almost every Denverite has a story of a birthday, anniversary, or other affair spent there. And the lobby continues to host afternoon teas for ladies in hats. And at the beginning of the 20th century, living amongst this splendor, sharing her new life as the belle of Denver society, was Isabel Springer. But first, let's meet the man who brought her into this high society. Jonathan Springer. Born on July 16, 1859, in Jacksonville, Illinois, the son of attorney John T. Springer and nephew of Congressman William M. Springer. The younger John Springer discovered while studying at university that he was an incredible speaker, and these skills he discovered in his higher education would make him a popular politician and help him not only in moving up the ranks in politics, but also in various social circles. He was a superior debater and was even asked to give his university's graduation speech in 1879. Then, after practicing law in Illinois for 10 years, he moved to Texas, where he married Eliza Clifton Hughes, the only daughter of wealthy Dallas banker and cattleman Colonel William E. Hughes, on June 17, 1891. It was a marriage that was not only loving, it seemed, but would put Springer in a good standing both politically and financially. He took charge of Hughes' cattle interests, became a director of the Texas Cattle Raisers Association, and was involved in a number of other enterprises. Eliza gave birth to two daughters, Annie and Sarah. But sadly, Sarah, who was born in 1889, died just 9 months later. Annie Clifton lived to be 48, but also died tragically, believing she had a brain growth that was terminal, and she died by suicide, decades after her younger sister's untimely death. But the tragedies for John Springer would not just end with his daughters. In 1896, while Annie was a young girl, he, Annie, and his wife Eliza moved to Denver, a a common practice during the era of rampant tuberculosis. Move to a place warm and dry to help with the patient's cough. And so they did, as his wife Eliza was suffering from tuberculosis and had been for years. A year after their arrival in Denver, Springer became vice president of the Chamber of Commerce, one of his first political positions in the new, bustling city. Springer and his father-in-law, Colonel Hughes, were linked by marriage but also their love of show horses. And in 1900, the two men were prominent in the Denver Athletic Club show. Their entries won several ribbons, including classes 4 and 4 in hand, turnouts, and saddle mares. They had some of the best horses in the league. And through Springer's successful land purchases, within a year, he had acquired several thousand acres in Douglas County, and two of his purchases included the original 160-acre homestead claim of Mary Burkhart and Samuel A. Long's acres next to the Welty's Cheese Farm. It was on Long's original homestead land, which already had several buildings, that Springer began the development of a pedigree horse ranch. And then in 1901, along with his wealthy father-in-law, Mr. Hughes, they joined together in the horse operation, and they increased the ranch size to 23,000 acres. The two men purchased 3 award-winning stallions and 150 quality mares. And these extraordinary animals were imported from Germany, where their blood pedigree went back several centuries. The Springer cross-country horse and cattle ranch soon gained a reputation for the quality of its horses. Springer stated in his business model, quote, "The avowed purpose of the ranch is to turn out an ideal American coach horse with sense, style, action, substance, and endurance." And with such a successful beginning, Springer began the expansion of his ranch by improving the buildings on the land and erecting new ones, including large horse barns to house the increasing number of horses. The original brick silos connected to the barns on the property provided storage for cattle feed during the winter. A windmill was erected high on a hill in the southern portion of the land and operated the primary well providing for the ranch. And at the same time, Springer began construction of his stately mansion. And this was an unusual move for a man of such extreme wealth. He decided to expand upon the structure that was already there. So he remodeled and expanded upon Long's original stone house into a German Baron-style mansion, complementing the structure with lavender and pink rhyolite stone quarried in Castle Rock, which was nearby. It was on both the exterior and the interior walls, and limestone was used for the many improvements and additions to the remaining original structures. When this structure was complete, it became the center of weekend entertainment for the state's political leaders, and this was important for a man whom connections were critical. And Springer revealed years later that he kept a daily diary in which he noted the names of those who visited his spread.
The amazing adventures of fearless pioneer men and women who fought and conquered the West. To those whose senses still throb to the memory of Pike's Peak Rush, Colorado is indeed a homeland won from the red man and nature. In 1857, some Cherokee Indians brought the word 600 miles across desert waste and mountains to Iowa that a little gold and silver had been found near Pike's Peak. It should be a state and admitted to Congress.
Hey, there ain't 500 people in the whole 600 miles, counting the braves and squaws.
You're forgetting the papooses, Tom. They sure swell the population.
Just a minute. This meeting is getting a little out of hand here. Yeah.
All right, man. Let's listen a while now to Trader Jack Jones.
Right. It's true, I reckon, that we're 600 miles from nowhere in the Pike's Peak country, but it's beginning to fill up.
Oh, shut up, Tom.
Over at our area on the west side of Cherry Creek, they got 200 settlers, 5 women, bless them. On the east side of Cherry Creek, there's St. Charles.
That ain't St. Charles anymore, Jack.
What's that, Oaks?
We went in there this morning and found just some teepees and Indian traders. So we took it over and named it Denver in honor of Governor Denver of Kansas.
I guess things move pretty fast out here at Pike's Peak.
He ran for the office of mayor in 1904. But sadly, just 5 days after his loss, on May 22nd, 1904, Springer's 35-year-old wife, Eliza, finally lost her struggle with tuberculosis, and died at the couple's home on 930 Washington Street, leaving him a single parent of their 11-year-old daughter, Annie. Eliza's declining health had been a constant concern for him throughout the campaign. And shortly after Eliza's death in 1904, later that year, the vast mansion was finally complete. It was a castle. Inside, the stone walls were enhanced with high, raising stucco and timbered ceilings. The main floor included a formal receiving room, a large dining room, a complete kitchen with a butler's pantry, a billiard room, a library, and a grand ballroom. The floor of the ballroom was polished oak, which was covered by Navajo rugs for protection when not in use. The rooms of the main floor were decorated with Western flair, including draperies made of doe skin, and the furniture was often adorned with deer antlers. An elegant staircase led to the bedrooms for the family and quarters for the staff, which encompassed the second story of the mansion. He was very, very happy with this mansion, and he called it Springer's Castle. That was until he met his second wife. Enter Isabel Springer. Isabel Springer, the butterfly, a nickname given to her for her love of attention and flighty disposition. She was born in 1880 to James and Amelia Patterson, either in Arkansas or Michigan, both of which she claimed at various times. As a child, she moved to St. Louis with her family and grew up in comfortable surroundings. Her family was among the city's social set, but not what she would grow and marry into. In 1900, when she was only 20 years old, she married John E. Folk, a traveling shoe salesman. The couple moved to Tennessee, but the marriage was not going well. And right from the beginning, Isabel claimed that he was emotionally abusive, and sometimes physically abusive. And she was vibrant and young, and she loved to party. And so she would often go back to St. Louis and hang with her friends and family and live the life that she was more accustomed to. Eventually, by June 1906, the two were separated, and Isabel moved back to St. Louis, and she took up residence in the Jefferson Hotel, the epicenter of the city's social scene, where she spent time hanging with the wife of a wealthy man from St. Louis. And the two were regularly seen cruising the city together in their 80-horsepower touring car. And I'm sure that was a sight. Isabel had large dark eyes and a round soft face. She was beautiful and delicate looking with an enviable figure. She had a large chest and a tiny waist. Her big brown eyes were always on display as she often wore her hair up. And she had a strong nose, but it suited her. Her face was almost pouty looking, angelic, and she was once described as shatteringly pretty. She was charming, adventurous, and could hang with the highest of society and have many suitors falling at her feet. She often wore the style of the times, big oversized hats, blouses with huge sleeves, long dresses with just the tiniest bit of ankle exposed. It was a style that Isabel upped the ante on. She was jazzy and seductive. And her flair extended into her personal life. She lived in a time where women weren't allowed to vote, and the suffrage movement forged on, yet women like her, though classy, didn't always stick with the norms of traditional society and what their good mothers and fathers would have wanted for them. Isabel was a bit of a party girl, and she knew she was beautiful. And she played the role like a Hollywood actress. She must have known she was destined for greatness and attracted it just the same. While living at the Jefferson Hotel in St. Louis, Isabel met her impossibly wealthy, soon-to-be husband, John Springer. A man who made sure Isabel had all the comforts that could be desired in the world. She had maids and housekeepers. She was chauffeured around. She lived a life of ultimate leisure and spent much of her time reading romantic fiction. Perhaps she picked up a few seduction tips here and there from the pages of her books. Her meeting and then marriage to John Springer set the stage for her dramatic rise to the highest pinnacles of society. But first, she needed to divorce her current husband. In court, she cited his abusive behavior. And he did not contest the divorce. And it was granted on December 23rd, leaving her free to marry John Springer on April 27th, 1907, at the hotel they met before starting their new life in Denver, Colorado. The papers began gossiping when Isabel arrived in Denver immediately with her wealthy new husband. They said, quote, "We always thought John was pretty fair-looking, but his wife is a stunning beauty. And it is safe to prophesy that the Springer home is going to be a social center." A quote from Denver Post columnist Eslyn Brown. What the papers didn't and couldn't know at the time is that this union would end in one of the most critical and sensational murders in the history of the Queen City. A story that could compete with true crime dramas today, and a trial and aftermath that would seal that fate. Isabel's boredom, romantic trysts, and affairs all started within St. Louis, the acres of her estate, and the halls of the massive castle that her husband John Springer eventually named Castle Isabel. And then, eventually, the Brown Palace Hotel in Denver. The two men that would eventually feud for her were Tony Von Fool and Frank Henwood. Tony Von Fool was a striking, hulking man at over 6 feet tall and 220 pounds. He was solid muscle and athletic. And Tony was a ladies' man. Not only was he large and athletic, but he had deep-set blue eyes, and he was adventurous. He was 33 years old, and the most beautiful women in his hometown of St. Louis flocked to him and his daredevil ways, and his abilities as a pilot, a cowboy, and a race car driver. When he landed in Denver and got off the train on May 23, 1911, he had only one destination of importance, the luxurious Brown Palace Hotel, where his little belle, Isabel Springer, wife of prominent businessman and politician John Springer, would be waiting for him. It seemed promising after so many of Isabel's letters spoke in terms of endearment and hope for a future together since January when they had rekindled their fling. They originally met on one of Isabel's trips to visit friends in St. Louis, away from the watchful eye of her husband, who was on business trips at the time. Some of the times she would attend his trips, and almost always she would travel with him to New York for the excitement and glamour. But if it was a less desirable location, she'd either stay back in Denver or go to St. Louis to visit her old stomping grounds, and the city in which she married John Springer, and catapulted herself into the highest of society. And on one such trip, she met Tony Von Fool. Being married was not a deterrence to Isabel. It seemed if she wanted something or wanted to do something, she did it. She fell for Tony on that trip, and even after returning to Denver and her life with her husband, she wrote letters to Tony for months, calling him Tony Boy, and saying she wished he could tuck her into her little bed and kiss her goodnight. And this is according to the Colorado Historical Society. And remember how I said if Isabel wanted something or wanted to do something, she just did it? Well, Tony Boy wasn't the only other man in her life. Enter Harold Francis Henwood. In March 1911, so just a few months after Tony and Isabel rekindled their affair, Isabel met Harold Francis Henwood, 35, an exotic man who was born in Naples, Italy, to wealthy parents who were vacationing there when he was born. He was a suave dresser and looked every bit the part of a handsome, savvy businessman. He had softer blue eyes, but was just as much of an adventurer as Tony. He was a world traveler, and he had his hand in many different businesses that took him all over the world. He landed in Denver intent on meeting an investor for his American Gas Company, which was planning to build a gas plant in the city. And John Springer was the perfect man to land on. They hit it off as business partners, and Henwood luckily found himself linked to a man, Springer, who was not only excessively rich, but gave Henwood access to Denver's elite business and social circles. And then, John Springer unknowingly also gave Henwood access to his wife, Isabel. Isabel first met Henwood by way of her husband in Springer's office in March of 1911, and the three became fast friends. And I wonder if John Springer suspected anything at all when he would hear Henwood call Isabel sassy, and she would call him Frank. And then on May 17th, Henwood started a five-day stay at the Springer's 12,000-acre ranch. And he would be back often for business discussions, and mostly it was social occasions, though. And sometimes, actually, many times. Isabel and Frank were the only socialites in attendance at their two-person gatherings. It's clear that Isabel loved attention. She loved to be complimented and adored by multiple men, but also the press, who would regularly comment on her status and her beauty. She was the turn-of-a-century trophy wife with a secret life. She wanted for nothing, and John Springer gave her everything. But the riches and the attention of one man, let alone two, but now three, seemed Isabel's need for more was unquenchable. And this is where it gets soap opera level dramatic. Isabel was unable to decide between her two secret affairs. May 20th, she'd written her bedroom letters to Tony and asked him to come to Denver, which he made the trip and arrived on the 23rd. On May 12th, she had met with Henwood, Frank, to ask him to get her back some letters that Isabel had written to Tony, which she said that they were just foolish little letters. And it seemed to paint Tony as a controlling man who wouldn't give them back. She said he even threatened to blackmail her with them, saying he would show them to her husband unless they resumed their relationship. And Henwood wanted to be the knight in shining armor and agreed to stand up to Tony and get the letters back, but on one condition. Isabel needed to also write a letter to Tony saying it was over between them, and Henwood would be the only other man in Isabel's life. Isabel refused, but Henwood dictated a note for her and told her that she would be handing it over to Tony when he arrived in Denver. And when Tony checked in, he was given a letter by the front desk that stated this, quote, "This is just to let you know that someone knows a great deal. Therefore, under no circumstances, telephone me or try to communicate with me in any way. Everything is finally and absolutely off, and if you wish to save yourself serious trouble with someone and his friends, you will forget that you ever knew me. Personally, my future is of too much consequence, and I'll never risk it." And then she here crossed out the word again. "I will send someone to you to have a final talk with you, and you must be guided by what they say. I have been forbidden to see you or hear from you in the future, and I have given my word, which I propose to keep, not to see you again. I have taken this means of letting you know." End quote. Now at this point, Henwood is obviously aware of Tony's arrival, and in a bold act, Henwood sent a bellboy to pull Tony out of the bar. After Henwood introduced himself, he said, quote, "I wish to have a conversation with you regarding a subject you are concerned with. I am the person referred to in the letter." And Tony quickly agreed to a 5:30 p.m. meeting in his room. Within the next 30 minutes or so, Henwood saw Tony speaking to a man at the front desk. He thought it was suspicious, and he approached Tony and said, "Well, are you ready for me or aren't you?" "I'll be there," Tony answered, just before he exited the hotel. And the next part is going to be a little confusing, but I'm going to read it directly from the book Murder at the Brown Palace, an extremely well-written and researched book by Dick Crack. And it's not confusing because of his writing. It's just confusing because there's a lot of drama going on. And Dick Crack also wrote a story about a case that might involve the town I live in Colorado. So, Dick, I'd love to speak with you. You do amazing work. So after Tony left, Henwood quizzed the clerk behind the counter. Quote, "Where did Mr. Von Poole say he was going?" "To Daniels and Fisher," said the clerk, giving Henwood, a relative newcomer, directions to the large department store at 16th and Arapaho Streets, 8 blocks from the hotel. Furious, Henwood jumped into the taxi and headed for Daniels and Fisher, the finest department store in all of Denver. In minutes, he found Isabel, her mother, and frequent companion Amelia Patterson seated nearby. There was no sign of Tony. Henwood used the moment to chastise Isabel, who must have been alarmed to see him. Quote, "Isabel, you haven't told me the truth about this. You are going to meet Tony here, contrary to what you had promised, and you would let me see him first and talk to him." Caught off guard, Isabel responded, "No, no, I'm not. Now, Isabel, I know better. I know he's on his way down here. You said he wouldn't see you, and now you're about to meet him. That is the worst thing you can do. When you reach a point with a person that is threatening to you, the time comes for a showdown. Make him know exactly that you are not going to let him go any further." Again, she denied she'd spoken to Tony, which was unfortunate because at that moment, he walked into the conversation. His first words were directed to Henwood. "Oh, eavesdropper, you hear?" Gazing at Isabel, he said, "I want to talk to this young lady alone." "You can talk to her right here. And you can't talk to her again alone in Denver or any other place," Henwood said as he took Isabel's arm. "I'm here to prevent you from breaking up this home. As a friend of both John and Isabel, I will deal with you for Mrs. Springer." That was not what Tony had in mind. Henwood's involvement was confounding an already confused affair. He became abusive. "I have a goddamn notion to spill you all over the place," he growled, apparently not caring that the place was a Palm Beach beck and shoe department of one of the town's classiest department stores. Henwood refused to back down. "Don't stare in on me. I won't let you do it." Tony's language became increasingly vulgar. Trying to calm Isabel and her mother, both visibly upset, Henwood suggested that he and Tony go back to the hotel and talk it over in a sociable way as they walked up the aisle toward an exit. Tony continued to air profanities on Henwood. "You're a damn son of a bitch and an eavesdropper. What the hell are you butting in for, you son of a bitch?" But, crazy enough, the two men took a cab together back to the Brown Palace Hotel. And then they made their way to room 404. It was Tony's room before he changed it to be nearer to Isabella and discuss it. Once in the room, things took a more hostile turn. And now I'm just sort of improvising the scene of events after that. I have it written down, but I'm trying to sort of make it more in layman's terms. Although, the author did an incredible job. So basically, they enter the room. And Tony is the bigger of the two men. And Henwood realizes that Tony has something bulky in his pocket. And he asks him, "You have a gun in your pocket, don't you?" Tony says yes. And then Henwood says, "I've never carried a gun in my life. And I think a man that does is a coward. And I have not come here for trouble. I want to talk with you like a man." And a lot of this evidence is from Isabel's handwritten notes, courtesy of the Colorado Historical Society. So they go over the quote-unquote foolish letters that Tony was trying to threaten Isabel with. Henwood says, "I understand you are making threats. And John, who is his friend, has reached a stage in his life where he needs all the comfort that there is. He is not a young man, and he is devoted to Isabel and I know that she is devoted to him, which is also funny because Henwood is sleeping with Isabel. But he says, I know that she worships him. I know that she would give anything in the world to have a free mind and be able to make John happy. For God's sake, Tony, will you break up this home? And apparently Henwood made a very serious misstep, because Tony was only known as Tony to his friends, and that familiarity made Tony very angry. And so Tony slapped Henwood across the face. Henwood then said, you are the first man who has hit me that I have not returned with a punch. Then Tony picks up the nearby wooden shoe tree lying near a table and brought it down on the left side of Henwood's forehead. And then they just went to blows. But then Henwood stopped himself again and said, I do not want a scene, hoping to put an end to the scuffle. Tony says, all right. He eventually unlocks the door, lets Henwood out, and then when Henwood turns around, there is a revolver pointed back at him. Even though he was scared, though, Henwood approached back towards Tony with the weapon touching his stomach, and he challenged him and said, you dirty coward, you dare not pull the trigger, you're a coward. Then there was a pause. Tony told him, get out of my room, you son of a bitch. I can't get you here because they would have it on me, but I'll get you, and I'll get you quick. So Henwood leaves. They eventually end up in the same room at the Brown Palace Hotel for dinner that night, and both are angry. Tony is with his cousin and another man. Henwood is alone. They both speak loudly, either laughing at each other or making remarks towards each other. But then it got a little more heated that night. Henwood was supposed to escort Isabel, her friend, John Springer, her husband, and her mother to the theater that night. But when he went to retrieve them, he was startled to see Tony speaking to them. Yet they still went with Henwood. But halfway through the production, Tony burst through the theater curtains and grabbed Isabel's arm. John Springer and Henwood both encouraged her not to go, but Isabel asked to be excused to get a drink of water. May 23rd ended without another scuffle. But what the heck was said between Isabel and John back in their room that night? I mean, he had to have been suspicious. And then, even stranger, early in the morning of May 24th, Isabel took Tony on a drive to the ranch with her mother, even though days prior, she had stated that Tony had struck her across the face for the first time, and she feared her safety and Henwood's safety. And she told Henwood to please drop this now where you are. For my own sake and my husband's and my future, you are not dealing with this in the right way. She also told him that Tony had threatened to kill him and he must stay away from the ranch and the Brown Palace. Just stay away. Well, oddly enough, Henwood, who claimed to have never owned a gun and believed that guns were for cowards, went to the hardware store on the day of May 24th and purchased a .38 caliber Smith & Wesson. The night of the 24th, the Springers, along with two other companions and the mayor of Denver, attended one of the theater productions. Isabel was described as one of the most striking beauties in the house that night, while her husband John almost had to be restrained from falling off of his box seats, ogling at the dancing girls, during a number where they stripped down to knee-length one-piece bathing suits for a beach scene in the play. But then later, on May 24th, one of the most shocking and headlining-grabbing murders occurred in Denver's history. Less than 10 minutes after the show ended, around 11:15 p.m. on May 24th, 1911, Frank Henwood found his way into the wine room also known as the Marble Bar, at the Brown Palace Hotel. It's known for its exquisite entrance, similar to the massive fireplace mantle near the 17th Street entrance. And Henwood was no stranger to the Marble Bar. He visited it frequently, after moving into the 7th floor of the Brown Palace while pursuing well-to-do investors for his employer. As he entered, Henwood scanned the assemblage for a familiar face, and then he approached the center of the bar near the beer taps and joined three men, all of extremely high status. Minutes later, Tony arrived with men of similar high status. Tony began joking loudly, "There's that son of a bitch I licked, and I ought to lick him again." And he leaned closer to his companion and asked him to switch places, putting Tony within 5 feet of his rival. Henwood spoke first and said, Mr. Von Poole, won't you consider what happened yesterday afternoon?" Tony looked at him, then told Henwood, "I'm going upstairs and I'm going to grab that gray-haired son of a bitch by the hair and pull him out of there and show him who is the master here." Both men knew he was talking about Springer, the husband of their mutual interest, Isabel. Henwood said, "You can't get that over on me." Everyone in the room tensed and knew there was about ready to be a fight. But what came next was unimaginable. Allegedly, Tony said, "I will get you first," and then he lashed out and put a sharp backhand right to the point of Henwood's jaw. Surprised by the suddenness of the blow and the fact that his head bounced off of the marble, Henwood thought that Tony had hit him with the barrel of the gun that he had also stuck him with in his midsection the previous day. Terrified, Henwood rose to one knee and struggled to jerk his newly purchased revolver from his hip pocket. And in an act of sheer desperation, rage, just an incomprehensible emotion these two men had been battling with for days now, Henwood, now on his feet, opened fire. Someone shouted, "He's going to shoot!" There were two quick shots and then a pause, followed by three more shots in rapid succession. For a man with no experience handling a gun, Henwood's aim was accurate. His target was also less than 10 feet away from him, which helped his aim. What happened in the seconds between the time that Tony had knocked Henwood to the floor and then Henwood came up firing is clouded in controversy. Henwood would stand trial in 1911 and in 1913 for the shooting, but witnesses, of which were there plenty, could not agree on a key issue. Some swore that Tony was facing Henwood when the first shot was fired. Others were just as certain that Tony had turned the bar and had taken a shot to his back. Henwood maintained that after he was knocked down, Tony fixed him with what was called a look of hate and threat. Some bystanders said that Tony appeared to reach for his right hip pocket, and many of them, especially Henwood, assumed a pistol, perhaps the one which he had threatened with Henwood the day prior. Henwood would get off 5 shots that night, a few of them killing Tony, and others hitting 2 other patrons who inevitably survived and were not interested in Henwood's apologies directly after the shooting that evening. When the event was over, Henwood said, "I did it." But he said it to no one in particular. He said, "I was attacked." He was appalled that he had wounded the 2 other pedestrians, Copeland and Atkinson, and he broke down in tears and said, "I didn't mean to do it. Oh, please just let me touch him. I didn't mean to do it." He then sat quietly on a couch in the lobby until policemen, who had been walking by and heard the shots, came inside and placed him under arrest. Tony was pronounced dead at 11:20 a.m. the next day, almost exactly 12 hours since the shooting. And when it came to John Springer and Isabel, John Springer divorced Isabel within 5 days of the incident. He had read the intimate nature of the letters that Isabel had sent to these men. And not only that, was the center of a murder in Denver. John Springer then spent the rest of his life retreating from public life after divorcing Isabel in 1911, shortly after the horrible scandal, and made all efforts to separate himself from the embarrassment and pain of Isabel's indiscretions and manipulations. But thankfully, he met a beautiful young woman named Janet, who was said to be as equally as beautiful as Isabel, and was just 32 at the time of their marriage. They remained married till the end of their days. His time as a power broker long past and in poor health, John Springer chose to live quietly in a small house in Littleton until his death at age 85 on January 10th, 1945. Among the main people involved in one of the biggest scandals and murders in Denver's history, John Springer was the last one to go out. He was the last living principal in one of the biggest sensational stories, but he had love for the rest of his life. He died about 12 years prior to his third wife, Janet, who died in 1957. And they are buried beside each other in Littleton Cemetery under a huge blue spruce and a simple granite marker that reads, Springer, Janet E., died October 3rd, 1957, and John W., 1859 to 1945. And that is the story of one of the most tragic and dramatic and senseless murders in Colorado's history. Thank you guys so much for listening. And if you're enjoying the show, please leave a 5-star rating and positive review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Love you. Bye.